This is Medical Spa MD. Hello everyone and welcome to the show where we help cosmetic physicians reclaim control of their medical practices and lifestyle. Even if you're clueless about running a business and you're already working a 60-hour week, Medical Spa MD, of course, brought to you by medicalsparmd.com, a worldwide community of physicians practicing cosmetic medicine. Hello, Jeff.
Hello, Andy. How are you doing?
I'm very, very well, thank you. Coming up in this episode, a bit later, an interview with Dr. Setu Mezumdar. I hope I've got his name right there. But first, what's new? What's been happening? Medical Fusion Conference still going forward?
Medical Fusion Conference is still ramping up. So, you know, we want to encourage everybody who can to take a look at the site or go on to medicalfusionconference.com or, you know, take us up on the special offer on Medical Spa MD and visit us there. So we've made the Medical Fusion Conference a select partner. So if you go to the site and you click on select partners, you'll get a page and it will have all of the special offers there. And you'll probably want to take us up on that since they're pretty spectacular, actually.
Fantastic. I've got a question for you, Jeff.
What's the question, Andy?
The question is, do you use Twitter?
You know, I did use Twitter quite a bit. I mean, there was a little bit of a fad there probably about 6 months ago or something where, you know, we had multiple Twitter accounts and we were using it to promote things and stuff quite a bit. Now, I have to admit that my usage of Twitter has kind of dropped off. It is something that we still do use, but there's a few challenges that we've kind of come to realize with that and with certainly with limited resources in any of the businesses or endeavors that I'm involved with, you always have some kind of limited resources. So we still kind of keep it up. We still do use it. We still have, you know, if you measure across the, you know, our Twitter accounts, certainly thousands of followers, but the activity stream on Twitter is not probably as large or as heavy as it was probably 6 months ago. What's your experience with that, Andy?
Me as me as what I do, a podcast producer and stuff like that. I started using it as an experiment about a year and a bit ago. I was quite a late adopter, I would say, of Twitter. So I just use it as an experiment. And to be honest with you, of late, I have twit faded slightly.
Is that the term, twit faded?
I just made it up. I'm just hoping it's like I've created a new word that will just like carry on and have a life of its own. So now it tends to be less frequent tweets. It's strange, Jacob, because I come across people that say, oh, you know, I've got a website and what should I be doing? And I'm always finding myself saying to them, well, do you want some more clients? And they go, yeah, yeah. And I say, well, get on Twitter. And first thing you want to do is get yourself an account and then search for your keywords, you know, in your world, and just see who's talking about what you do, and then start following them. About half of those will follow you back, and then start putting some useful bits of information out to help people.
You know, and I think that that's where a lot of people kind of drop the ball, and probably myself is as guilty of this as anyone, is trying to provide only real, actual value into the Twitter stream. It's so easy to do, I think, that it tends to be a domain of, you know, useless information and spam to a large extent. And for an individual that's really connected with their best friend, totally fine and appropriate to be, you know, the sun is shining here and it's just started raining and those types of things. But for a business that's looking to potentially use Twitter as marketing, it's challenging to kind of break through that dross and really connect with people in a kind of a meaningful way that, you know, that will actually both provide value, help your reputation, help your, you know, trust in the marketplace and drive revenue.
Yeah, I've recently been combining useful information with useless information to see how that goes. And so, for example,
did you start out with only useful information?
No,
or
I
only
started
useless?
Off with useless information, like the old classic. You know, I'm having sausages for breakfast or something like that. And then I started to give out more useful information, like, oh, have you seen this website? Sort of linking to useful articles and things that I've written. And now it's more of a combination of, I'm sitting in the Red Roaster coffee shop writing the book on podcasting and things like that. So it has been very experimental, my Twittering. But I think it's a very good way of connecting. I have connected with some people, some useful contacts through Twitter.
Yes, and that's I think the challenge is actually kind of coming to grips. Now, I just recently read that 25% of all tweets actually have a link in them, which I thought was about right, actually, you know, based on my experience of what I see. It's often the case that somebody will just tweet, links. You know, but when you have a stream, and this is often the case that businesses exclusively, and it's easy to do, hook up your Twitter feed to your blog or something else so that when you publish content that it creates a link and it says, you know, our newest blog post is here and puts in a tiny URL. The challenge is, though, that's in effect, because it happens automatically, nobody has to do anything, and that's the only thing that goes out. Mm. And that's not really providing value or connecting to almost anybody. And I think that you know, this is again one of the challenges of commanding these new kind of social media and marketing efforts, and physicians that are able to adapt to these and actually use them to their maximum will, of course, gain a significant advantage in these kinds of marketplaces, as opposed to you know, the yellow page ads and the you know, call in, come in to the office before we'll actually even speak to you.
Mm-hmm. I think it's all part of the personal thing as well, just showing that you're a real human being. This is why I mean, you alluded to it just earlier. I don't like the idea of automated tweets going out. I know you can get like plugins that plug into your, you know, your WordPress blog, so that when you put a new post out there, it just automatically tweets it out. I always liked the slightly more personal approach. I don't know how you feel about that, Jeff.
Well, I think that's exactly right. Everybody likes that. Now, I have plugins. I use these because it is one more way of getting both the word out and driving traffic to your site, and there are some probably ancillary benefits from that. Now, that being said, if that is the only thing that you're putting out, you're in effect shooting yourself in the foot right there, because you know, nobody wants, you know, you're not providing enough value that anybody actually wants to listen to what it is that you are saying. I mean, that's really the benchmark of how you're going to build a community around your medical practice and raving fans or zealots, as opposed to, you know, somebody who came in and got treated and, you know, feels sixes about you, is the other stuff that you do. It's not the treatment. It's not the specific outcome. It's all of the other things that you do that kind of go into developing a sense of trust inside of your marketplace, and can really turn patients who have, you know, kind of gone in and had a treatment to those patients that feel personally offended if somebody else has a treatment from a different clinic or physician. I mean, we've all had those, and every practice has those patients that are real zealots, and they bring in their friends and they go out and they, you know, walk the streets and talk to people looking to help your practice. Every clinic or every business has some of those. But if you're smart about what you're doing and do it, you know, correctly, you can have, you know, instead of having a dozen of those or five of those, you can have 20% of your practice being like that. And really the trick of that is, it's not a trick, it is actually providing real value, as opposed to kind of just lip service to a number of these kinds of things. Yes, we have a Twitter feed, and yes, we have a Facebook page, and yes, we send out a newsletter and some other things, but how much value do people actually derive from that? I'm a big proponent that the more value that you provide and send into your existing community, the stronger that community becomes. And the more business results, in effect, you're going to be able to draw out of that community over a period of time. You know, it's a little like compounding interest. And I'm a big proponent of compounding interest. It's the little things that you do. You know, it's it's like a new website, Andy. I mean, you're familiar with this. It's every time you add content to the site that is valuable, it's kind of a little another grain of rice out there. Now, if you only got 6 grains of rice, it's not really a full meal. But if you have, you know, hundreds or thousands or tens of thousands of blog posts and comments, and they're relevant, where somebody can go and find information that they're looking for, and put yourself in a position that of one of trust, because you're only, you know, you're looking out for somebody's best interest, no matter what that person may be. That kind of comes across, and those, you know, that can really help, you know, the success of your practice and actually make you money. It's not only good sense to put that into the community, it's actually very, very good business sense.
I came up with a phrase in my book a few weeks ago, actually. It was passive publicity.
Yeah.
And the reason I came up with that phrase was because when you build a sort of raving fan base through social media, whether it be Twitter, whether it be Facebook, whether it be LinkedIn, whether it be podcasts or videocasts, you do have this kind of ongoing chit-chat, hopefully positive, about you and about what you stand for and about your brand that goes on whether you're there or not. I think more so than before we had social media, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Now, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be you as a physician who is doing this. Now, some physicians really are actually quite good at this and do this quite a bit. You know, you'll bounce across these physicians and they're, you know, you're like, are you the one doing this? And it, meaning because they're putting out a lot of content both on Twitter, and they've got a, you know, video feed on YouTube, and they're doing a lot of stuff. And some of them are doing it all themselves and they really enjoy this. For a lot of physicians, it's not really practical to spend 3 or 4 hours a week, even as little as that might be. You know, you're saying, well, can't you fit 3 hours in? Well, possibly. But if you are working 60-hour weeks or 80-hour weeks, or, you know, you don't enjoy it, there's no reason that you actually have to do that. But as a business, you need to either have your front desk doing it, or somebody needs to be providing value. And, you know, the training for that, and, you know, is not extensive by any means, but somebody who's doing it needs to have a little bit of a personality. And there, you know, there are, I won't call them tricks, but I'll say well-known, you know, well-known methodologies for treating people online and developing relationships. Having a personality and being slightly funny, you know, is something that works actually quite well. Being human. I mean, we'll talk in future podcasts about training around, you know, consultation room and, you know, front desk operations and interactions with patients and best practices for physician consultations. And a lot of it has to do with your marketing and sales materials really should be setting in you up, and you'll probably hear this phrase a few times during this podcast, is really designed to put the physician or the practice on a pedestal. And what I have always taught my physicians is that, you know, my job is to put you on a pedestal so that the patient sitting in the consultation room, when you walk into the room, they already have a tremendous amount of trust in what it is that you're going to say. We've done it. We've done a good job, and we've put you in the very best possible light. When you walk into the consultation room, you're on a pedestal, and your job is to step off of that pedestal and talk to that patient one-to-one as a real person. Now, some physicians are really, really good at this. One of the best that I ever saw was a physician that we hired, and she was with the Park City Clinic up here. Her name was Ida Bergstrom, and she's since left. She's practicing in Washington, D.C. area. She is just fantastic about walking into a consultation room and making the patient feel as though she is a trusted advisor. And that's, you know, there's an entirely different kind of mentality, because she is actually looking out for that patient's best interest. I mean, that was one of our you know, what I always told every member of all of our staffs and physicians is that I don't care if we lose this treatment, you know, I don't care if they do not need this, do not sell this to them, because
you've got the patient's best interests at heart.
Well, and the reason is really it's slightly philanthropic in that I just do not want to put anybody in a position where they are selling something that the patient doesn't need, because it kind of comes across. And it damages not only your reputation when that gets out, and it always gets out, but also your camaraderie and the way that your clinic operates. Mm-hmm. If you are forcing your front desk staff and your nurses and your laser techs and estheticians to, in effect, sell things that people really don't need, it is just corrosive. And so the other thing is that it's kind of a one-time sale. So when we would have a patient and they would come in and they would think that they wanted Botox, but they didn't have any wrinkles, and our patient or our, you know, physicians would go in and say, you know, you really don't need Botox. First of all, they would really, you know, sometimes they'll try and actually get that, but you say, look, there's nothing that's going to be a benefit. You're going to waste, you know, $300 or $400. You're going to drive no benefit from this. You do not need this. Come back in 6 years when you're starting to develop crow's feet and we'll talk. Mm. Well, what happens when you do something like that is your trust, in effect, just goes through the roof. And it doesn't matter that they did not get that treatment from my clinic at that time, because within the next 3 months, I'm going to see them again. I mean, we saw tens of thousands of patients in our clinics, and that is almost invariably the case, is that when you have that level of trust, I mean, cosmetic medicine is a desire, and the fact that you didn't give somebody a treatment did not quench their desire to do something. Often, you know, it's the case. I'll tell you one story is our very first clinic came out of originally was a pain management clinic, and so you had a lot of people in there, and it amazed me what would happen. We had a patient come in, and this is a patient that was probably tipping, you know, 90. She was probably 90 years old. Mm. She was in a wheelchair. She had probably about 6 months to live. She was in a tremendous amount of pain, and she wanted laser hair removal for the hair on her upper lip. I mean, of all of the possible things that she might need, this was very, very important to her. Now, I can speculate on the reasons, and we probably can all figure out, you know, exactly why she might want this or not. Mm. But it is the case that, you know, cosmetic medicine has a very large kind of powerful draw for most people. I mean, I would, you know, tell our physicians, look, we're in the vanity business. That's really what we are. We are not here saving lives. You know, there are times when we are going to do a tremendous amount of good. I remember one patient came in and she had a birthmark. This is actually a good, interesting story. She had a birthmark that covered probably about a quarter of her face. On the right side of her face, she had a very, like, you know, these deep purple birthmarks that went up. It covered her ear completely and went up kind of the side of her face. Mm. Super noticeable. I mean, it was basically as though her face was, you know, a quarter of it was like bright purple. Mm. And she came in and we, you know, went through a number of treatments. I think she had six or eight treatments in order to treat this. And in effect, unless you actually knew that it was there, we got rid of this. And that literally changed her life. And in some very odd ways, you know, one of the things that she became extremely conscious that people would actually look at her when they would talk to her. There were tears. We literally changed her life. She was a 35-year-old, you know, mother, and had always had this, since she was born, and had always grown up with people looking at the kind of the right side of her face when they kind of talked to her. I mean, it was almost impossible not to, because it was so
sure, yeah.
Distracting that. But when we got rid of that, that literally changed her life, you know. Or if you're a 16-year-old high school girl and you come in and we treat you for acne and we're able to help you kind of manage that so that you're, you know, the high school abuse or that, you know, those types of things stop, that literally can change somebody's life, especially in those kind of formative years. You know, high school kids with acne is with severe, you know, acne that you can actually kind of help is both challenging. Acne is a challenging treatment modality for sure, but is also extremely rewarding when you're able to actually do that, because it's not, it's different than, you know, Botox or treating somebody's crow's feet, right? That's just personal to them. It's not really going to change their life dramatically, but occasionally those things will happen that make you feel, you know, they're pretty good, feel good moments.
Right, well, shall we move on to this interview with Setu Mazumdar?
Let's do that. Let's see what Dr. Mazumdar has to say.
So let's just do a little bit of background on Setu. He was a valedictorian of Woodward Academy, and then he attended John Hopkins University. He earned his Doctor of Medicine in John Hopkins School of Medicine. And then he went on to also doing a lot of financial stuff and investments. Interesting guy. Let's have a listen to the interview.
So Setu, you are both a wealth manager, a financial planner, a certified financial planner, and an ER doc. How did that kind of come about?
Well, I think it kind of goes back to when I got out of residency. I finished my emergency medicine training in 2001. So this is, I guess, my beginning of my 10th year in practice for emergency medicine. And the whole transition kind of came about through a couple different avenues. When I got out of training, you know, I was making probably around $35,000 a year in residency, in my last year of residency at the time. And all of a sudden, in 1 month, and July hits, and I started getting a real job, and then my income went up by, you know, over 10 times. And so, like many physicians, I thought, well, gosh, you know, making all this money, surely if I went through all this training through medical school and residency and everything, that, you know, I can certainly handle my own investments and pick the winning stocks and all that kind of stuff. And the reality was, is after a couple of years, I realized that, one, I really had no clue what I was doing, because we basically didn't have any sort of training. I mean, I can't even recall a single hour in medical school or in residency, not even a single hour on the business aspects of medicine, and certainly not on financial planning.
You would think that medical schools would understand this problem. Why isn't that the case?
Now, I'm not exactly sure why that is, but my opinion on the matter is that when you go through medical school training and even residency training, you know, the vast majority of these training centers are academic centers. And so while you get great medical training, there's very few people in academic centers who've actually run a physician's practice. For one thing, and secondly, they're basically trained themselves in a situation where they didn't get that training to begin with, so it's hard to impart something, knowledge of something that they themselves didn't have any knowledge of to begin with. What I kind of find fascinating is probably one of the biggest things that concerns physicians when they get out of training are business practice management issues and then their personal finances. But to me, it's pretty amazing that none of that's really covered at all in a medical school curriculum, and certainly not in residency training. So, I mean, my opinion on the matter is probably that since these are mostly academic institutions, the attendings and the faculty who work in academic institutions don't really have a grasp of these issues to begin with, and so it's not really integrated into part of the curriculum, when in fact it's really a big part of our personal lives. I mean, to me, you know, it's not just that you have medical training. Once you get out, you really have to integrate your career with the rest of your life. And by not focusing on the rest of your life, I think is a huge gap in medical training right now. And I think it's going to continue to be. I don't see how that could be changed based upon the curriculums I've seen in various medical schools and residencies.
Well, it seems that every physician should understand this. These are often one of the first kinds of questions we end up talking about. It has to do with business or finance or money in some way. You would think that all of the physicians, including the ones that are the academics, would understand that there's a kind of a gap there and kind of move towards filling it, even if it was just by providing some opportunity for residents and physicians that are in training to get this kind of an education or help.
I agree. I mean, I think there should be at least some sort of basic financial planning and business management courses or lectures or some sort of even hands-on sort of training and residency, but it just doesn't happen. It certainly didn't happen to me. And even speaking to the graduates who are coming out of training who've contacted me, who've read my articles and other things, asking them, they even say that even now that's just not the case, that they didn't have a single amount of exposure to any of this stuff. And it goes way beyond that. For example, emergency medicine, which is my specialty, you know, one of the big things in emergency medicine is that very few emergency medicine physicians are actually owners in their practice. They're generally independent contractors. And so they have no ownership whatsoever. So when people get out, they're basically sort of like hired guns, basically. There's very few democratic groups, and the whole issue of, how do you form a democratic group, what's the advantages of having your own practice or ownership of it, is not even discussed, except maybe for a couple of places. I went to a residency program that actually did discuss that particular issue, since the my residency director was actually one of the founders of the American Academy of Emergency Medicine, which really kind of focuses on democratic physician groups. But you know, beyond that, it's really not something that's discussed really much in the medical circles, at least not in the training. It's all about, you know, all the academic stuff and not all the other stuff that factors into your life after you're done.
So you graduated, you started making some money, and then playing around in the stock market and stuff, and realized that you'd didn't have the information and knowledge that you thought you needed it by that point.
Yeah, there's a couple issues. One is, you know, like a lot of physicians who get out, they say, well, you know, well, if I went through medical school training and I went through residency training, this grueling training, then picking the winning stocks and picking the right mutual funds and all this stuff is easy. And then what I realized after a couple of years was, one, I had really no clue what my returns were. And secondly, I started reading all the academic studies and academic research in portfolio management and financial planning, and that's when it hit me that everything I was doing was wrong. But there's a second motivation here as well, which is that not only was I doing it wrong and I had no clue, my colleagues who were all physicians didn't have a clue either, for two reasons or two aspects of that. One was, if they were managing it themselves, they were making the exact same mistakes that I had made. And the other issue, which was probably really fueled my passion to go into this, was that a lot of physicians who had financial advisors had advisors who basically were not acting in the physician's best interests. And to me, that was shocking, because as a physician, morally, ethically, and legally, we're always required to act in the best interests of our patients, whether it's in the ER, whether in the office, in the ER, urgent care, clinic, wherever you work. You know, that's kind of our legal and moral duty. The problem with most financial advisors is that that is not the case, and it's perfectly legal to do it that way. And so I was seeing all these physicians who had these advisors who basically were trying to sell them products and get a commission off of it, which to me doesn't resonate with objective advice. And I was seeing a lot of physicians who had been ripped off and burned by so-called professional financial advisors who, in fact, were only trying to sell them stuff. So I kind of took a look at this and I said, you know, I've got this incredible passion for this. My assets have grown because I did a good job of saving, and I'm seeing these physician colleagues of mine who basically weren't getting any sort of objective advice. Wouldn't it be a great idea for me to use this passion of mine to be an advocate for physicians, but on the personal financial planning side? And that's how kind of the whole thing blossomed into what it is now.
Now, was this something that you had a seed around starting some other business other than clinical practice in the past, or was this really something that your plan was to go into clinical practice and then you saw a need and, you know, decided at some point that you could address it?
Actually, when I got out of residency training, I really had no idea I was going to do this. You know, my goal was, okay, I'm just going to work really hard and do as many shifts as I can and make as much money as I can. But you bring up a good point is, you know, why would you change from one thing to the next? And I think the other thing that happened to me personally was that as the years went by and as, you know, I got married and I had kids, I all of a sudden started to question, okay, yeah, I'm making all this money, but I was almost somewhat miserable about it because I wasn't really enjoying it. It had night shifts and weekends and things that I was missing. And so I took a big step back and said, okay, hold on, what really makes me happy? Is it doing all these nights and making this money, or is it spending more time with my family? And, of course, I chose the second. Now, basically what I'm getting at is that I kind of had this big transformation between myself and my relationship with money and what it means and what it's supposed to do for me. You know, when I got out as a single person, you know, not being married, it was just, okay, I'm just making this ton of money. Now it was more of, you know, I use money as a tool to get me where I want to go, which was being financially independent and not so dependent on that income to kind of lead the lifestyle that I want to live. So it's kind of all those combination of factors that led me into the whole thing. And oddly enough, what was happening is I saw so many of my colleagues that were miserable, that they're doing all these shifts and they're not getting anywhere. A lot of physicians are very frustrated right now about all the stuff that's happening, that they're losing autonomy. And for me, this was a way to say, hey, look, you know, I felt the exact same way, but there is something you can do about it, which is to transform your relationship with how you view money and what it's all about.
So you were in clinical practice. You'd kind of fooled around and found out that you weren't great at it, that you'd made a lot of mistakes. How did you go from being a novice to somebody who is now running a business in which you're touting your expertise in this area?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, the first thing I had to figure out was, you know, how do I get from working a full-time emergency medicine shift per month to doing full-time financial planning? How do I get from point A to point B? I mean, I didn't know where to begin because I thought that, you know, all I had to do was go to Merrill Lynch and Smith Barney and all these places that, you know, everybody knows about and get some sort of training there and just become a financial advisor. And I think what happened, from what I recall, from you know, 6 years ago or so when I started this whole process, is I came across a group which was called the National Association of Personal Financial Advisors. NAPFA is kind of the short term for it. Most people have never heard of NAPFA, and there's a good reason for it. But this is an association that basically said, you know, there's something wrong in the financial services industry, which is that advisors are paid by commissions. Why should it be like that? Why can't the client pay the advisor a fee directly? And that, to me, resonated with me huge, because I was seeing all these physicians that had advisors that were commission-based and had inherent conflicts of interest. I said, you know, I need to contact people in this group. How do I do that? So it turns out that NAPFA, all across the U.S., and usually the major cities, have these study groups. And so I called up the leader of the study group here in Atlanta, and I said, hey, you know, I'm a physician. I'm interested in financial planning. I really don't know how to make this transition from what I'm doing now to what I want to be doing. And so I started going to the study group meetings, meeting a ton of independent advisors, what are called fee-only advisors. And I started interviewing a bunch of them and saying, hey, you know, what would you suggest for me to do to get from point A to point B?
So your goal really was to move from clinical practice to be full-time financial advisor for a physician?
Not when I got a residency, but as my passion grew for all this stuff and all the things that happened to me in my personal life and seeing other physicians, then I made the decision, this is what I would do because I love it so much. It's kind of like there's a saying, I think it's, I can't remember who said this, I think it's some sort of Chinese proverb or something where it said, if you choose a job you love, you'll never have to work a day in your life. And that's kind of the way I look at financial planning and wealth management is I love it so much that I don't feel like I'm working. And that's the best career to have is when you feel like you're not working, but it's a career, that's where I want to go.
So do you think you chose the wrong major in going to medical school?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. I mean, the actual science of medicine, I think, is still fascinating. And if it were just, okay, I see the patient, I take care of the patient, and, you know, everybody else leaves me alone, then, you know, fine. But turns out that, you know, whether you work in the ER or other professions, you know, you don't actually practice medicine that much on a daily basis. Most of it is just ends up being administrative, stuff that, you know, I didn't sign up for, stuff that I don't even think should be in my job description. And it turns out a lot of the things that we as physicians do now really should be the job of somebody else. So it's kind of a loss of autonomy is the way I kind of look at it. The other thing with emergency medicine in particular was that I felt like we had accountability and responsibility without authority, meaning, you know, we were blamed for things that were beyond our control, but we couldn't change anything because we had no authority to do so. And so to me, that wasn't the right way to treat physicians. And it wasn't really a matter of arrogance or any sort of, you know, I'm better than somebody else. It's more of, okay, if I'm the one seeing the patient, then I should be the decision maker, not somebody else. And when you take that aspect away, the whole physician-patient relationship just breaks down. You can't have something where the physician seeing the patient and somebody else who's a non-MD is telling me what I should be doing, and then me not having the authority to change anything.
Do you think that's a characteristic of emergency medicine that does not extend into kind of private practice or private clinics?
Well, I know that it's absolutely true in emergency medicine, but it's spilling over a lot into other other specialties as well. So one example of that would be, you know, a big trend that's happening now for example, cardiology, internal medicine, and so on, is that it used to be even 10 years ago that you'd have these small physician practices, and now what they're doing is all these hospital practices are buying out all these independent practices. And so it used to be, you know, you drive down the highway and you'd see kind of, you know, just these regular billboards. And now what you're seeing is these billboards that are advertising physicians groups, and they'll have to stick this, you know, face of this doctor on there, wouldn't even put his name. It'll just be, oh, you know, such and such hospital physicians group. So I can't imagine a scenario where the physicians in those groups would have a huge amount of authority.
Let me ask you this, because you bring up a very interesting point. Is that the most efficient way to deliver healthcare? Is it more efficient to have consolidation as opposed to kind of a myriad of independent physicians? Is the delivery of medical services made more efficient by that kind of a model?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not sure what the answer to that particular question is, since I wouldn't have anything to back up any sort of data with evidence. But from kind of my perspective is, let's say it is more efficient. I think kind of the bottom line is that it ends up becoming less personal than what it used to be when, you know, had these smaller practices. And I think a lot of the patients are even saying so. I mean, like, I work in urgent care now as well as, and I used to, of course, work in the ER, and a lot of patients would come in and ended up primary care doctors, but it's become a lot less personal, which is really not what medicine should be, at least from a patient-doctor perspective. So I don't know exactly what the answer to that question is, whether it's more efficient or not. Plus, it depends on how you define efficiency, whether it's number of patients per hour or is it, you know, reduce costs or what it is. But to me, the disturbing trend is the loss of autonomy that physicians have experienced, not just in emergency medicine, but what I'm seeing for other specialties as well.
Which is why we had, you know, Medical Spa MD has, there's so many physicians now that are, we're not thinking of cosmetic practice when they went through medical school. They were family practice or ER docs or internists, and have now moved or migrated towards cosmetic medicine as a way really to kind of gain control of just that kind of autonomy, to get rid of, you know, third party reimbursement and all the insurance and those types of things, and kind of gain a little bit more, well, gain a tremendous amount more control over their, both their finances as well as their kind of lifestyle, and be able to set that themselves. So you made a kind of a transition, and but you're still practicing clinical medicine. Is that because you have the need to do so, or you still just kind of desire that, and you feel that you're really balancing these two kind of career paths and are able to do that?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two reasons. One is, you know, you go through all that training. It's almost like an insurance policy. Let's say something happens and this financial planning business fails. Well, as a financial planner myself, I better have a plan, a backup plan for myself, just like I advise the clients for their personal finances. So that's one issue. The other issue is that since my niche market is specifically mid-career physicians, I think it would be a mistake for me not to work a couple of shifts a month to know what the challenges and the trends are in medicine itself. So if I completely just stopped and did financial planning, 30 days a month, then the concern I have is that if I want physicians, or specifically mid-career physicians, as clients, it's much easier for me to relate to them if I still am in that profession and know what the challenges are, know what the trends are, know what the frustrations are myself, and that way I can convey that to clients saying, hey, look, I'm one of you. I know what you're going through because I see it. I still practice, and I can relate to it.
You decided to target mid-career physicians for what reason? Is that because that's where kind of the belly of the market is? Is there, is that a business decision on your part, or was it because you feel you're in that kind of group, and it's this kind of relationship that you have?
Yeah, I think really was to specifically answer that question is, it's kind of even a little bit more narrow than that, which is, first I started with this concept of, okay, I'm going to have physician clients, and that's my market, but it was still too big. So then I said, well, who are the people that I really relate to? And, of course, the people that I relate to are people who are like me, which is mid-career physicians. Now, the people who are out of residency training, I could argue very well that perhaps they need more financial advice, and maybe they have more need for an advisor than maybe anybody else, because if you can prevent huge mistakes that early on, you'll be much better off. The only downside to people who are just out of residency training is they're in a huge amount of debt. A lot of them don't see the need for an advisor, and frankly, a lot of them just don't want to pay a fee to anybody. But the people who are kind of mid-career, the ones who've started families, who are several years out of training, generally 5 to 7 years or more out of training, who now have all these complex issues, what happens if I die? What happens to my kids? Am I saving enough? I've got college things looming. Now they got estate planning issues. And these were the exact same issues that I faced personally for my family. And so for me, you're right. Mid-career physicians is part of the group that I'm part of. And so for me, it's just easy to relate to them. The people who are pre-retirees or nearing retirement, certainly I don't necessarily exclude them, but I can't relate to them as well as I can the people who are kind of basically mirror me and the challenges that I face currently.
You mentioned, avoiding the mistakes just after you graduate. What are the mistakes that physicians commonly make?
Yeah, that's a good question. That's one of the things I'm going to talk about in the conference, but to kind of give you an overview, if I had to choose a couple of huge mistakes that physicians make in their personal financial planning, the first one is that they don't have a plan. And what I find kind of ironic about all that is, when we apply to medical school and college and residency, we kind of sort out all these, here's where I want to go, here's the pluses and minuses of this program or that program, and then we start looking for jobs, here's the pluses and minuses of, going here or going there. But when we get out, now all of a sudden we don't have a plan at all for our personal finances. And by a plan, a lot of people just say, well, okay, I got out and I'm just going to pick a couple stocks and do this, that, and the other. But none of that is really integrated. And so, to me, the biggest mistake is that people don't have a comprehensive financial plan for themselves that integrates not just investments, but, protecting their wealth, growing it, and, of course, ultimately transferring it when they die. Those issues need to come up pretty much as soon as you get out of training. And that's, I haven't really found that many physicians that have done that. That's one big mistake, is not having a game plan. But the other two are, or other couple that I see are, one, second is overconfidence. And this kind of gets back to my personal experience, which is I thought, gosh, I can do this myself because I went through all this training. So, surely doing all this financial planning stuff is easy. It's kind of like there's all these surveys done saying, well, gosh, 80% of drivers think that they're above average drivers. Well, that's mathematically impossible. And if you look at a lot of physicians, they suffer from this overconfidence syndrome, which is that, hey, I can do this myself. And they get into all these speculative investments, all these things that they probably don't need, and a lot of them end up getting burned. One of the huge other things, like I mentioned before, is choosing the wrong advisor, which one of the wrong advisors, it turns out, is yourself, which is, you know, a lot of people try to do it themselves and make huge mistakes. On the other hand, it's kind of a catch-22, because if they hire somebody, then the chances are huge that they're going to get somebody who's not really acting in their best interest.
It sounds as though you have very little trust in kind of the rank and file financial kind of systems that are in place for most Americans. Is that accurate?
Absolutely. I mean, you would be surprised the egregious, absolutely horrendous things I've seen from prospective clients I've met who are all physicians. And the stuff that their previous advisors and when they've come to me, I look at some of this stuff and I say, gosh, this is just, you know, if we were physicians doing this to patients, we'd be in jail.
And what would examples of that be?
Here's a great example, and this is an example that I see just routinely over and over and over again. So you have a physician who, for example, has an advisor, and I kind of look at their portfolio, for example, just kind of focusing on the investments for now, there's all these kind of mishmash of different funds here and there. And one of the things that I asked prospective clients and even my current clients is, hey, look, you know, what fee are you paying to your advisor? And the number one response I get is, I don't know. And to me, that's a big red flag right there. If you don't know what fee you're paying to your advisor and he hasn't told you, there's something wrong. And, you know, to me, not disclosing fees up front is one of the biggest things that really sort of makes me mad, because then you really don't know whether the advisor is really acting in your best interest or not.
And so if you're a physician, what are the questions they should be asking if they're interviewing a financial advisor?
Yeah, that's a good question. The first and probably most important question is, how are you paid? The most common fee structure is commission-based by far. Advisors are paid by the transactions they make and the products they sell. So, for example, you could have insurance agents that mask as financial planners who basically sell you initially insurance products and then go around and sell you mutual funds in your investment accounts purely for the commission and the kickback that they get, but they don't actually disclose the fee. So the first thing you want to ask is, how are you compensated? If it's commission-based, you've got to have your antenna up, because then you know that, hey, look, you know, if this person is going to advise me, how can they possibly advise me in an objective manner? They're just trying to sell me products. The second is what's called fee-based, which is not the same thing as fee-only. Fee-based is kind of a combination of charging commissions and fees directly. But again, there's an inherent conflict of interest there because they're still partly commission-based. And then there's fee-only, which is kind of like a CPA that basically says, okay, I'm a financial planner and I'm going to charge you this dollar amount fee. I'm not going to get paid by any third party, and these are the services you get from me. That's it, clean cuts. So the first thing you want to ask is, what are the fees that you're paying? Second thing is, what kind of education and training do you have? You'll be shocked at this, but there's really no formal education or training required to become an investment advisor. You basically go up to your state's securities department, you know, they fingerprint you, you sign an application, you take the short test about some basic you know, legal stuff, and wham, in about 2 months you can call yourself an investment advisor. So what you want to look for is kind of a bit more of a formal pathway, and the best I know of is the Certified Financial Planner curriculum and program, which really kind of focuses on not only investment planning, but kind of integrating that with retirement planning, estate planning, insurance planning, education planning, and those other things.
Are there any financial planners who are paid based on performance?
Depends on what you mean by performance. There's two ways to define it. If you strictly define it as you'll be paid by a percentage of the gains The answer is yes, there are some that are out there, but those, for example, for me as an independent, I can't do that. I'm not allowed to get paid by specifically charging fees based upon performance. The common ways to do it are, at least for on the investment side, a percentage of assets under management, or flat or hourly fees is another model that that you can do. So I guess technically a percentage of assets could be technically performance fees, but the way that the SEC, which is my regulatory body, defines it is a percentage of the gains that are made, and I'm not actually allowed to do that. Now, there might be other people that do that. Hedge fund managers, for example, do that, and they're not really regulated by the SEC at this point.
What are the positions who are more successful with their financial planning? What do they have in common?
Well, first of all, I think it's a very small group. Most of the people I've met, sure, they might make high income, at least according to the IRS, but you know, having high income and being financially successful, I think, are two separate issues. So if you're spending all the money that you're making, you're probably not going to accumulate enough assets where you can call yourself financially successful. But the common traits that I see are, one, having a kind of a comprehensive plan in place. The second kind of thing that I've noticed is people who basically say, you know, I've realized that I can't pick the winning stocks, I can't time the stock market, I can't pick the winning money managers. The best I can do, and what all the academic research says I should do, is match the market. And the third, of course, is staying disciplined enough to stay with the good times and bad, as well as kind of taking the approach of, okay, you know, I really don't know what the future holds. It's completely uncertain. I don't know what my income is going to be. I don't know if I'm going to become disabled. So, you know, I'm going to leverage, you know, time on my side and, of course, increasing my savings to make sure that I have enough to retire on. So those are, I mean, it all sounds kind of basic, but you'd be surprised that most physicians don't do those things.
So you brought up another interesting point, which is matching the market. Why would I need a financial advisor? And why wouldn't I just, you know, invest the money that I'm going to put in the market, whatever percentage that is going to be, and have it, you know, match the S&P 500 or invest in a matching fund?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, I think if you look at all the data that's done on this issue, exactly answering this question is, okay, here's a great study. This comes out about once a year, maybe once every 2 years. It's called the Dalbar study. And here's what it basically says. It says, okay, you take the past 20 years, and if you're just stuck with the market, and this includes 2009 and 2008 and all the you know, kind of the bad things that have happened in the past decade, if you take the past 20 years, you just basically stuck with everything, you still would have had a pretty decent rate of return, around 8% a year. It turns out the average individual investor, their return over the past 20 years, and this is the way this is calculated, is based upon mutual fund cash flows across, you know, tens of thousands of different accounts and different custodians. The average individual investor got a rate of return under 2% a year. The market returned about 8% a year. The average individual investor got a rate of return about 1.88% a year. Turns out inflation was about 3% a year. So basically what the conclusion there is that investors, when they do it themselves, are getting in and out of the market at exactly the wrong time. They're essentially buying high and selling low. And so one of the values of an advisor is basically discipline. And people tell me, well, gosh, you know, do I really want to pay for discipline? And my answer is that's actually the number one thing you should be paying for, because your own worst enemy is usually yourself. And all the data show that. But then there's all these other issues, like, you know, investments is one thing, but how do you integrate that with, you know, estate planning, or, you know, how do you know if you have enough life insurance, or how do you know if you're saving enough? How do you know, you know, this, that, or the other? And it's kind of like medicine is too vast of a field for somebody to kind of sit down, if they have an inclination to do so, and really figure it out.
What if you are inherently, you know, not risk adverse? How do you kind of handle clients but are attempting to do things like start new businesses and grow their way into financial success?
Well, kind of the way I think of it is, like, for example, if one of the goals of a physician is to say let's say they don't want to work full time doing clinical stuff and they want to open up some other business, the real question is, you know, how do you get there? How do you go from, you know, doing full clinical stuff to say opening a new business or whatever it is that your goal is? I think one of the key things that people have to consider is getting their financial house in order before you make that jump. Because like any other business, even for example, for me personally, you know, making a jump from clinical medicine to doing this, you've kind of have to make sure you've got enough saved up and that you can weather out some of the lean years where, you know, you can do marketing and have all these expenses that maybe you didn't have before. So one of the key things I think if anyone's considering a career transition is to make sure your personal financial situation is in order before you make that jump, because you could get burned if something fails. So you know, that's kind of my take on it, is that one of the key things you got to have in place is your own personal financial situation being squared away before you can say, okay, I'm going to start this business or do this or that or the other or go part-time or whatever it is that you want to do.
How long does it take for a physician who comes in and, you know, is in that state to get his financial house in order?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, the way I kind of look at wealth management is it's not a one-time event. It's more of an ongoing or dynamic process that is ongoing over the lifetime of that client. So it's not just a matter of, okay, here's where I am now. We've got everything organized, reinvested. You've got the appropriate insurance in place. You've got all this stuff. And then, okay, goodbye. We'll see you in 5 years. Because there's always something that's happening. An example of that would be, and these are real examples for clients that I have, is, for example, you know, one person buys a new house. Well, now you got to look at, you know, all the asset protection stuff on homeowners insurance and umbrella policies all over again. Another client, you know, their group 401k plan switched from one custodian all the way to another custodian. Now their investment options completely changed, so you have to redesign the entire portfolio. You know, having a newborn, you know, that's going to create issues of, okay, do I need now more life insurance? How do I fund this person's college if that's one of their goals? So there's always something going on that requires monitoring of this. But to kind of answer your question, what I found is that especially in the first year of the engagement is huge, because you're establishing trust with the advisor and the advisor's establishing trust with the client, and getting in all this stuff that's generally disorganized usually takes about a year and a half to kind of really go through and get everything squared away. And it really kind of depends on the situation. I've had people who, you know, for example, one client I've had who had, you know, like 8 different checking accounts. I'm not really sure why. And then had all these other scattered investments that weren't really sort of integrated with each other. And then I've had other clients who, you know, had all these variety of insurance policies, life insurance policies from way back when that they'd never looked at in years. And the questions were, you know, do you really need these? But roughly, you know, the first year is really something that, you know, takes about a year, year and a half to really kind of organize everything and simplify it. And then it's more of an ongoing relationship where you manage the investment portfolio, and of course you monitor the goals of the client and making sure we're headed in the right direction.
When you moved over and started this business, what were the first steps that you kind of took? I mean, you basically became, set out a shingle. How did you start marketing? How did you kind of grow your business? What was your plan?
Yeah, what happened is, when I went into this, I started taking the Certified Financial Planner courses. That was, I believe, back in 2006. And then I didn't feel comfortable going out on my own after I passed the CFP courses and the CFP exam. So what I did is I worked for a wealth management firm here in Atlanta before I went out on my own. One, to give me confidence, but the other issue was, you know, I wanted to kind of see the inside business workings of actual fee-only financial planners and see kind of, you know, what are the marketing challenges, you know, how do they get clients, you know, how do they conduct meetings, all those sorts of issues. And it gave me an idea of the way I wanted to do it. I actually started this firm in January of this year, so this is still a refined, you know, this process is still being refined as we speak. But basically, you know, the first several clients that came on board were people actually that had been reading my columns that I write in one of the ER magazines for the past 3 years. And when a couple of them contacted me, said, hey, you know, I've been reading your columns and now I noticed that you started this financial planning business, and they came on board as clients. There are others that heard from other people that I was doing this that came on board as well. You know, it's always, marketing is kind of probably the biggest challenge for me is, you know, how do I get the word out? Because, you know, there's not really that many physicians who are financial planners. So the key for me is, you know, marketing towards, you know, how do I get the word out that, you know, I'm one of you and this is kind of a unique thing.
Do you find that physicians kind of respond well to that, the fact that you're an MD as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's an instant connection, especially with emergency medicine physicians, of course, since I am one of them, but even for other physicians in general. But one of the things I've noticed is, you know, physicians are just so busy with their career and other things going on that they kind of don't have their, you know, personal financial planning on the radar screen a lot of times. You know, the excuse is always, okay, you know, I'm going to do this later. Because, I mean, let's face it, who wants to really look at their will?
It is a little like tax season.
Yeah, exactly. It's like taxes. Or, you know, who wants to look at their will? It's not fun. Who wants to look at an insurance policy? I mean, that's just not exciting. I mean, to me, it's exciting because I enjoy that stuff. But for most people, it's like, you know, I'm just going to deal with that later. And I think on a superficial or on the surface, people know that it's important. It's kind of like diet and exercise. You know, I mean, you could tell somebody all day, well, you know, the key to losing weight is to, you know, take in less calories and exercise more. But how many people actually do that? It's kind of the same thing here. It's like, well, gosh, you know, I know getting a will is important, and I know getting the portfolio together is important. But gosh, you know, that's just not something I want to do. And
so let me ask you, as a career, are you able to make more money as a physician, or if you're successful as a financial advisor, is that a more lucrative career?
Yes, that's an interesting question. One, it depends on the number of clients, of course, and the fees that I charge per client. But here's kind of the way I look at it, and this is just my take on the whole thing, is I don't look at income. My take on income is very different than what it used to be. It used to be that I was just looking at, okay, you know, here's the dollar amount I'm making per month, and that was it. Now I see income more of, okay, here's the dollar amount I'm making divided by the frustration factor. And so to me, high income to me basically means the highest amount of income per frustration factor. And I can tell you that what I'm doing now is so much more fun than doing an ER shift with all the challenges of working in ER, that yes, my absolute income will even when I get up to the number of clients I want, will probably be less than if I was just working full-time in the ER. But from my perspective, when you take into consideration all the frustrations, there's far less frustrations doing this, and it's a lot more fun. I actually think I make more, if you know what I mean, when you do it relative to lifestyle.
As a final thing, is there anything that you kind of want to mention that you know, in the discussion that we've had, is there anything else that's kind of come up that you might want to, you know, throw out as a nugget of wisdom?
The way I kind of look at, especially since the conference and everything and what you're doing at Medical Spy MD, I think the one thing I'd have to say is if there are physicians who are simply trying to, that don't like what they do right now, for whatever reason, whether it's income going down or, you know, they're frustrated with paperwork or admin stuff or malpractice or whatever, what I would suggest is that don't do something else just to get out of the other thing that you were doing. Do something else because you have a true passion for it. If you don't have a true passion for this other career, whatever career it may be, then you're ultimately going to not like that either. And the thing I found is that if you have a true passion for doing something, then it becomes much, much easier to motivate yourself to do it. And that way you're not miserable in the second thing you did. You know, you're actually enjoying it and living the life that you want to live. It's kind of the biggest thing that I'd probably have to say for anyone who's considering transitioning from a full-time clinical career to maybe part-time clinical and full-time something else, or full-time something else.
Well, that's it for the show. Thank you very, very much for listening, and we hope you enjoyed it. Of course, we would like to have feedback, so if you've got any questions or comments, the email address is podcast@medicalspamd.com, or leave a comment in the Physicians Forum at the website. If you're a subscriber, that's terrific. If you haven't subscribed yet, and you want the shows automatically delivered to you when a new episode comes out, you can find Medical Spa MD on iTunes just by searching for Medical Spa MD, or visit the website medicalspamd.com and click on podcasts, and there's ways to subscribe there as well. Now, as always, please consider everything we say to be complete conjecture and random speculation, not medical or legal advice, and laws and regulations vary everywhere, so do consult a medical or legal professional before taking any action. So that's it. It's goodbye from me, Andy White.
And goodbye from me, Jeff Barson.
Wishing you the best until we see you next time on Medical Spa MD.